Clang, clang, clang went the trolley. Ding, ding, ding went the bell.
It's Liza with a Z, not Lisa with an S, cause Lisa with an S goes snuds.
Let me hear you say, hey, Miss Carter.
Don't cry for me, Argentina.
Snap out of it.
Who told you you're allowed to rain on my parade?
There can be 100 people in the room.
Liza!
I'm Robbie Latour.
And I'm Tequila Mockingbird.
Welcome to Divas on Divas,
the podcast where we make our diva obsession your problem.
Tequila Mockingbird, today, you haven't congratulated me yet, but today marks the first time that I have set up all of this equipment and not accidentally been recording through the microphone on my laptop. How great is that?
Congratulations, Robert. That is wonderful.
I think you'd be more supportive of me in future. It's the small wins that we need to celebrate.
I love it because every time, I believe it's every episode so far that we have...
Every episode.
Yeah, we've accidentally
not
been...
Not just every episode, but every record. We've done other things.
Yeah, for the everything that we've recorded so far.
The 6 or 7 times that we've set up.
Yeah, and today you got it right. Well, congratulations for you.
I have inevitably every other time been recording through my laptop microphone and we spend about 5 minutes going, why is the audio awful?
It just doesn't sound right. Why do we sound so tinny?
Why did we spend so much money on podcast equipment when we sound like this? Tequila, it is a very exciting day. Episode 4. It's always an exciting day when we're recording. You've made it more exciting because you've brought not one, not two, but 3 bottles of wine to my house.
I did bring 3 bottles of wine, yes, Robert. And I have... Well, we finished one already, so that's good.
Yes, well, we set up to record and went, something doesn't feel right. And then we realised what it was.
We weren't drunk. Which I think, as we said in one of the last episodes, I think it was the share episode, it really is the third person that helps us along is alcohol.
Let's be honest, it does most of the heavy lifting.
It really does. It really does do all of the heavy lifting.
Can't rely on you or I.
So, Robert, we have a very exciting diva today, one of my personal faves.
I know you're very excited about this one, Tequila. I am excited for you.
Admittedly, you didn't know much going into this episode about...
I wasn't going to admit to that, but you've given up the goat.
Well, since I've called you out.
No, it's one of those things where we do a bit of research for the show and you start getting into it and you're like, gosh, I don't know as much as I thought I knew about this particular person who I have no excuse, and I apologise to all the big fans out there.
It's going to be really interesting today because during our segments, I have a lot of like really obscure stuff to talk about with this diva because I find that she's an anomaly.
Well, would you like to tell everybody who it is?
Okay. Today's diva is the one and only Barbara Streisand.
That's for those of you who didn't read the episode description before you press play. It is this interesting thing where people seem to claim to know a lot about Barbara, but she's a bit of an enigma.
She is an enigma, and she's a very private person as well. And there was a lot of things that I was really excited going into this episode to talk about. There's a lot of stuff that used to be rumor and conjecture, but has in recent times been proven to be fact.
Yeah, right.
And I can't wait to delve in.
Is she a bitch? Is she not? Stay tuned and find out. I don't actually know that we're going to be able to give a definitive answer to that question, but we've sure got some evidence.
We're going to fight either side of the argument today. Let's find out.
And if not, we're just going to fight. All right, let's get Shirley Bassey in. Let's get the show started.
Where do I begin?
Born Barbara Jones Streisand on
Streisand.
Oh, don't. You know I don't know how to pronounce it. I already told you that. So what's the difference? Streisand?
So there's Streisand, which is Zand, which is a lot of people say, and Sand.
Because Liza with a Z goes...
Yeah. So Barbara with the S goes not Z.
Okay, all right. Let me go again. Born Barbara Joan Streisand.
No. Streisand.
Oh, God. Okay, one more try and then you're just going to do it. Born Barbara Joan Streisand.
Nope.
Okay.
Streisand.
You do it. That's the same as what I said.
I love that you can't hear the difference.
I can't.
She was born Barbara Joan Streisand on the 24th of January, 1942 in Brooklyn, New York.
This is really surprising to me. She's 78 years old.
Yeah.
I didn't realise.
Yeah.
I had no idea. She's actually quite a lot older than the other divas that we've talked about.
Yeah, quite a bit older. She's older than Cher.
I mean, older than Judy by default.
She is, and she's older than Cher.
She's really
how good does she look?
Great. I mean, as soon as I found that out, I googled like recent pictures of her. And I was like, yeah, gosh, no wonder I didn't know.
Yeah, give me the number of her surgeon. Dr. Zismore, book me in. Her mother was a soprano who never made it into show business, and her father was a school teacher who passed away when she was 15 months old.
She has one older brother, Sheldon, and a younger half-sister, Rosalind, from her mother's second marriage.
She unsuccessfully auditioned for MGM at the age of 9, and by 13, her mother had assisted her to create a demo tape.
By 16, she was living alone in a tiny New York apartment in the heart of New York's theatre district.
Her real first success, however, didn't come until 1962 on Broadway at just 20 years old, where she got her first Tony nomination.
I know, imagine peaking that early.
20 years
God,
old.
What you wouldn't give. Oh, to have been out of peak at 20.
Still long waiting. Decline since 21. From there, she had many TV appearances, including with our very own diva from the podcast, Judy Garland.
I know, and how iconic was that alone? More on that later. Eventually, she released her debut album called the Barbara Streisand Album, very creatively titled, which was a Billboard Top 10 and won her 3 Grammys. She went on to star in Funny Girl on Broadway, earning her a Tony nomination for Best Actress in 1964. Talk about coming out of the gate nice and strong.
She has recorded 36 studio albums, 9 live albums, and contributed to 15 soundtrack albums. She is attributed to releasing over 117 singles, and she starred in 19 movies.
Some of her big songs, of course, are The Way We Were, You Don't Bring Me Flowers, Memory, and from our very own intro, Don't Rain on My Parade.
She has been in a plethora of movies, of course, starting with Funny Girl in 1968, the 1976 remake of A Star Is Born, yet another diva off this list that has been in a version of A Star Is Born.
Yeah.
She also starred in Yentl and, of course, the less critically acclaimed Meet the Fockers. I think it's really interesting. Okay, I'm just going to divert for a second. I think of Barbara Streisand as this. She is a writer, director, producer, singer, songwriter, you name it, she's done it. And she decides to join the sequel to Meet the Parents, which was Meet the Fockers, where you meet...
Well, do you remember when it was announced that there was a movie called that? I was shocked. I was like, how did they get away with calling it Meet the Fockers?
And I think it really speaks to a lot of her, like, her humour and how funny and, like, not self-deprecating, but, like, how funny she can be. Because she was like, sure, I'm going to sign up for this whatever sequel, and I'm going to make it. I'm going to be this hippie woman with this curly hair. And
I actually think she's quite funny.
She's very, very funny.
And
in
I think
it.
The movie's quite funny, but yeah, it doesn't bode well. I think she got a Razzie for it.
And I don't look at Barbara and I think this is the vehicle that she needs to be. That is going to really relaunch her career in the 2010s.
It's really interesting. The other 3 movies that we mentioned there, Funny Girl, A Star Is Born, and Yentl, which she produced, directed, sang in, acted, all of the above. It was completely her piece. They all happened really early on in her career. She is really, I mean, not that she hasn't had the staying power, but she is really, like, it's really heavy early on in quite how successful she was. Like, she really came out the gate blazing.
Yeah, and she really hit her stride at, like, an early age and sort of went, this is where I am and this is where I'm going to stay for a while, quite a while.
All right, marriages. She was married in 1963 till 1971 to actor Elliot Gould, who, interestingly enough, played Ross and Monica's dad in Friends.
Yes, I'm sure he's done lots with his career, but the thing that we most know him for
what I'm the
is,
most impressed
yes,
by.
Is for him playing, in Ross and Monica's dad and friend.
They had one child, Jason Gould, in 1966. She went on to marry actor James Brolin in 1998, who she is currently still married to. And, of course, her stepson is Josh Brolin. So a very acting-heavy, very highly accoladed acting-heavy family.
Yes, of course, we know Josh Brolin from most recently Avengers Endgame and Infinity War. He was Thanos in that. And James Brolin could still get it, as far as I'm concerned. He is such a hot granddad. I love it. She has 2 Academy Awards from 5 nominations. She has 8 Golden Globes from 16 nominations. She has 3 Emmys from 6 nominations and 8 Grammys from 46 nominations. I'm sorry for clapping into the microphone, but that is something that you just don't see.
Not only that, but she's also got the Grammy Legend Award and then 3 years later was given the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. I don't think anyone's ever cleaned up the Grammys quite like she has. And in fact, she's the only artist in the history of the Grammys who's been nominated in 9 separate categories for a Grammy.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So we spoke about earlier how she was nominated for her first Tony Award in 1962, but she didn't win her first Tony until 1970, where she was awarded a special Tony Award for Star of the Decade.
So interesting to me that she hasn't got a competitive Tony Award.
No.
So she's still attributed as winning a Tony. But considering, you know, her background and her how incredibly skilled in acting and singing she was and coming from that theatre background, it is quite surprising. And she's come so close to winning Tonys before. But, was given that Star of the Decade accolade in 1970.
It also makes her one of the only 15 people on the planet who've been given an EGOT.
An EGOT. Now, look, I'm going to stop there because we've talked about EGOT before on this podcast. Now, I was playing a little bit of the podcast for my husband, Dave, the other day, who said to me, what is an EGOT? Now, I don't know if that's grounds for divorce. It might be.
Well, the fact that he's not here right now speaks volumes.
The files are in motion. But maybe, should we explain what an EGOT is? Is there other people out there that don't know what an EGOT is?
Okay, let me lay it out for you dumbasses. Here we go. I'm sorry to call you that. What an EGOT is, for the uncultured among us, is people who have won an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony Award. So right. If you're an EGOT, you've got all four across the board.
Which is considered sort of the four major components of show business, right? You've got television, you've got music industry, you've got film, motion pictures, and you've got theatre.
Yeah. Also, fun fact, Barbara is one of the only people, there's only a handful of them, that have a Peabody as well.
Oh.
So she has an EGOT P.
She's really highly accolated.
She's really highly accoladed.
Like, she's broken quite a lot of records. She got her Hollywood Walk of Fame in 1976.
If this isn't a diva move, I don't know what is.
Oh, yeah. So she got her Hollywood Walk of Fame star in the category of motion pictures. She's the only person. We've talked about this in the past. You have to be there when you get.
Well, Cher declined hers. Cher declined hers because she couldn't turn up.
So she's the only person who has a Hollywood Walk of Fame star but didn't show up for the unveiling of it. Apparently she said that she wasn't comfortable with the crowds, but I don't know how this worked. Maybe she said it so late in the piece that they were like, well, it's too late to stop now.
They'd already laid the concrete. They were like, your star's down, Dal.
Maybe she's played it really well. But interestingly enough, she did show up in 1998 when James Brolin got one, her husband. I mean, it was 20 years later, so things might have changed
for her. It really does. It really plays to how she progressed throughout her career and how she went from being one person to another. And we see I'll talk about it at length later, how she really did literally went from starting out as one person to ending up now who she is.
Most recently, we've seen her in the news because she, of course, donated all of her Disney shares to George Floyd's 6-year-old daughter. When I was looking this up, what I found really interesting is that it's a beautiful thing to do, of course, but she also sent her 2 albums, which I just think is so funny. Like,
any publicity is good publicity.
Imagine this girl's mother explaining to her, all right, firstly, this is what a share is. You own shares in this company. Also, this is what a Barbara Streisand is. Here you go. Listen to these 2 albums.
And it's really great because I feel like it's what we're doing for our listeners today. This is what a Barbara Streisand is.
God, I'd love to know. It's a really beautiful move of hers and it will really set her up well for life. But I'm not sure what level of understanding is there about what's happening.
Okay, so we've laid out the facts and figures for you. Now it's time to crack into...
And isn't it iconic? Don't you think?
Yeah, I really do think it is iconic. Barbara Streisand is the only artist to have a number one album in 6 consecutive decades, the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and 2010s, which means she has a total of 11 number one albums altogether.
Right. So not to be confused with Cher's, who single has a number record. One single in 6 different decades, Barbara has the same thing for an album.
For albums.
Interesting. I want to talk about one of my favorite Barbara Streisand things.
This excites me, do it.
It's the single No More Tears. So her and Donna Summers together singing this really, I love disco music, right? And it's an epitome. Big fan. It's an epitome of a disco track, but it has one of the best drops that any song has ever had. And it's become this like really iconic drag performance because of that, because it's got this, it starts as a ballad and then becomes this, you know, this funky disco dance number.
Thank you.
love that for a funky song. How good is it?
If I've seen one drag queen do it, I've seen 1,000 drag queens.
And I love it. I love it every time I've seen it.
Because it's a ball. And it is one of those things. It's a real great thing, especially for drag queens as well, where you can walk out onto the stage and you can have two of you there and you're both in like a reveal coat.
Have you done it?
I have. Multiple times. So I used to do it with my drag mother and then my drag auntie as well.
I wonder how many drag performers haven't done it. It's this wonderful thing. And you know what's coming as soon as you hear that. It's raining. And it starts so softly.
And my love life is boring me to tears. So they'd be quite right.
Your love life is boring me to tears too.
But yeah, what an iconic bop to have somebody that wasn't particularly known for disco music either.
Yeah.
Someone who had been like a big...
Yeah. When I heard it come up, because as I was doing my research, I put on the essential two disc,
which I had as a kid, which was a big hit in my house of her with the perm. It was the way we were looking. And
you never had a chance.
I really didn't. I've had rainbows up my ass since before I can remember. So in 1969, she won the Best Actress Oscar for Funny Girl, but she had to share it with Katharine Hepburn for The Lion in Winter, which is the only time there has been a tie in that category for Best Actress.
Yeah, right. So this is interesting because we mentioned this when we were talking about Judy, that her Oscar was the closest in votes without being a tie. And it did make me wonder, when was there ever a tie? And here it is, Barbara Streisand tied with Katharine Hepburn.
Yeah, with Katharine Hepburn for The Lion in Winter. And it's crazy because Funny Girl now is eponymous with who Barbara is. She originated the role on Broadway and then took it to film as well. Mm. She is the only Fanny Bryce. People will come and go. Revivals will come and go. But the only Fanny Bryce for me is Barbara Streisand.
Have you seen her recently? She's been attributed with a quote saying that looking back on it, she was too pretty to play Fanny Bryce.
Fanny Bryce was an ugly woman.
Yeah, she was like, oh, looking back on it, I was too pretty to play that character, which is just such a...
It says a lot for her self-esteem and how she feels about herself, though. Because
must be nice.
With a nose like that, I don't know that she's... But she was, that was the thing though, with a nose.
I thought we were going to come with a nose on
it. With a nose, like you can't not do a podcast about Barbara Streisand and not mention a nose. With a nose, like that was the reason that she was cast in that role in the first place. So while it marked her first Academy Award, and that should have been such a big celebratory thing, it was her dress that she wore to the award ceremony that caught everyone's attention. So she wore a flared leg pantsuit with white cuffs, a collar, and it was covered in sequins. And it was by a Montreal designer called Arnold Scarzi. The outfit became completely see-through when the lights hit it.
Right.
So when she got up to accept her award, and she was completely unaware of this fact.
Right.
She got up to accept her award and the outfit, because for all of our drag queen listeners out there, you know when you get sequin fabric and you don't line it with something else and it's just the sequin fabric on top and they make a whole outfit out of it and then you shine the lights on it, the whole thing goes see-through.
Yeah, right.
Apart from the bits where the sequins are. So that happened, and it still to this day, it makes Oscar lists. So when they put up every year, when they put up like a worst dress to most iconic list, she features on every one of them.
Is there some visual or pictures of this? We can pop them up on the website.
You can see it online, yes. I will pop some pictures and some videos that accompany that up on the website.
We were talking before the show about one of the most interesting things about Barbara is she really brings up this concept of what is a diva. And it isn't a label that she's really taken kindly to in the past. In fact, she was on Jimmy Fallon several years ago where he sort of suggested that she was a bit of a diva, and she had this to say.
You're the one person who's allowed to be the diva of all divas.
No.
We can change the temperature in the room and the lights. And we still will love you.
No, divas were opera singers, first of all.
Oh, okay.
And how come they never call men divas?
Men are called divas.
Really?
I've been called that a few times. Yeah.
No, not you.
No,
I don't think so.
Thank you,
I think that.
But you're so. This is fantastic. I was like, I thought I just.
You know, I'm quite ordinary. I'm quite simple, normal.
Yeah, it's this really interesting thing that she brings up, because we've only ever discussed divas in the light of it being like
a good thing.
An honorary term.
Yes.
Right?
We love divas. That's why we're doing this podcast.
Whereas that's not how Babs sees it. Babs is like, you know, well, this is when you say diva, you mean dramatic, you mean difficult, which sort of speaks to the kind of image that she's had to fight most of her life. And maybe that's why she feels that way, but it does beget the conversation. Why is it only females that we call divas? Can a male be a diva?
I think it's a really interesting conversation to have. There is a really old stage adage that people would say, and I'm sorry, I am going to say the word on the podcast for the, I believe, the first time, but the saying goes, a diva is what you call a quack while she's still in the room. So that's old stage slang from years and years back that has gone through every theater set, every movie set from here to eternity. And it really is. They use that as a, in the business, it's used as a derogatory term. When someone is a diva, you think of the people that will only have red M&Ms in their trailer or will only have, for instance, the unsubstantiated claims that Mariah Carey only allows white furniture and red roses on her rider and things like that. It's those sorts of stories that are passed down through years and years where people think that these women in particular, these divas, are difficult. It's really interesting that we're doing this from a like an LGBTQIA plus queer community perspective, because we don't see our divas like that. We praise our divas.
We don't. And you know what? It's not the first time we've reclaimed a term as a community, right?
It's not.
The word queer, of course, was a slur that we now use to identify quite broadly with our community. So it's not surprising that as a community, we've taken this term diva and it means something different to us. But it does shine a light on the fact that maybe this isn't a compliment to everybody.
Which is very evident in this interview that she gave.
You don't go out in public all the time. You're not out on the scene.
It's just that I'd rather stay home.
And that you are very much a perfectionist.
But you say that in a way that is a little judgmental in a negative way.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think it's a plus. It's always a plus when it's a man, if you notice. When it's a woman, it's like she's a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
See, she's reiterating the same facts, and these are interviews that have been going on for years and years. Every time she gets asked about her diva antics and about the things that she's done on a set as a director or this, that, and the other. And I have another clip coming up where she calls out her entire team while working on Yentl about one tiny thing that she heard but wasn't really obvious to everybody else. And she was like, no, somebody's changed this. And it has nothing to do with her being a diva. It has everything to do with her having such a sense of her work and being so well aware of her work.
100%. And that's the point that I want to make too, in that I've watched a lot of these so-called shadiest or diva moment on the internet. I can't say that I feel like she is. I can say that I feel like she is confident and that she owns herself. That
and she knows what she wants.
She knows what she wants. And you know what? She's the artist and she knows how her voice is best represented. There's this whole clip where she's in the studio and she's coaching them because she feels like that they've processed her voice.
This is it. It's on the downbeat. Yes. Yeah. So, okay, we'll play it for you now. About? Yes.
Watching this, perhaps you can judge for yourself. Is Barbara the creative tyrant she's been cast as? Or is she a perfectionist, reasonably refusing to take shortcuts?
Let me tell you something. Hold on one second. Hold on. Listen to There's No Storm. There's No Storm. Listen to that.
There's no storm.
There's a longer chord before I say there's no storm. A downbeat, which is part of it.
She'd sing after.
That's right. I like singing after the downbeat. And not throwing me now.
She's singing at home.
Oh, I don't like this.
There's no storm yet.
I don't like that. That's exactly it. Please restore the four frames. I like what we have.
I had no problem with that. I had no problem watching that. I had nothing in me said, oh God, she's difficult or whatever. And they say it in that clip. And this rings really true. The narrator says, is she a diva? Is she a diva? Or is she difficult? Or is she a perfectionist that reasonably requests not to take shortcuts? And in this, that's what she seems to be doing to me. She's showing a profound knowledge of her music and how her voice works with music. She says, I prefer to sing on the downbeat. You know,
and she knew and she was so
and
well.
She wasn't going to compromise on
she
that.
She wasn't.
And why should she?
Why should she?
It's her brand.
It's her, but also, it's her movie.
God, we're getting very worked up on her behalf, but I get how that is easily over time being labeled as she's a diva, she's difficult, she's hard work. But the fact of the matter is, I think she has a point. A, if she was a man doing that, it wouldn't be.
There's so many directors throughout the ages who people haven't blinked an eye at when they've done something 100%. Like that.
And B, I think it's reasonable for her to protect her brand and...
But to want to produce the best kind of product as well. So obviously that was the 1983 film Yentl. And it not only did it show Streisand's colossal talent, she not only like directed, co-wrote, co-produced and sang some of the songs like in the film, Papa Can You Hear Me, Piece of Sky, all of those like iconic Barbara moments that we know, but she also starred in the leading role. The movie was almost 15 years in the making because various studios argued, so it took 10 years for them, they had to wait 10 years for them to release the rights to the book. Mm. And the second the rights became available, Barbara bought them and said, I'm going to make this film and I'm going to star in it. Yeah. It's something that she was very, very, very staunch on. And
it was her passion project.
It was her passion project, of course. And one of the most famous films that she's ever done. And a lot of studios argued that Streisand was too old to play the lead role and was also too much of a rookie to direct a film of that size. But she refused to drop the project and she got it to the screen and it all went her way and she got what she wanted.
Yeah, and this is borrowing from something that I wanted to say in Mirror, Did You Know? But she is the one and only female director to have won a Golden Globe.
For the best director.
For best director, yeah. For that movie. And that
the
was
the only one.
That was back in 1984.
Yeah.
And never has any...
Not since.
You know, female-identifying director since then won a Golden Globe, and neither has any before then. That is astounding to me.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's...
She also said that Steven Spielberg... She goes, I hate to toot my own horn, but Steven Spielberg said to me he couldn't change a single thing about the way I directed Yentl. It was perfection.
And if that's not a recommendation about your film. And of course, the film won the Oscar for Best Original Score and the Golden Globe for Best Original Movie, Musical or Comedy, and Best Director as well. So yeah, like, accoladed up to the fucking
And like we
hilt.
Said before, one of the only movies to have that accolade from a person who produced, directed, acted, sung in. Yeah, she's got this beautiful, like, perfectionist quality to her, which we see, it's such a common trait among our divas. There is this need to get it and do it right and to love it.
Diva.
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 Tequila, I want to share with you a moment, a little gem that I found on the internet. And I love this, particularly in the light of what we know about Lea Michele these days. Ooh. Is just this little snippet of Lea Michele talking about her experience with Barbra Streisand, which, if anything, gains her points.
Who's your, like, number one diva of all time?
Barbra Streisand.
I knew it. I had to ask.
Of course. I asked her for a picture once and she said no. And I was like, diva, that's okay. Anything for you. Yes.
Shut up, Lea Michele.
I would also have said no to a photo with a racist like Lea Michele. I'm not going to lie to you, Robert.
I'm not shocked.
But also knowing what I know about Lea and the thing that came out recently, I don't know if you saw it, where an extra on the set of Glee recounted a story where Lea Michele had her fired. She didn't like her for whatever reason. She had her fired and then had her reinstated because she found out she was Barbra Streisand's niece because she wanted to get closer to Barbra Streisand. That has been corroborated by multiple sources on the internet. You hop on Twitter and go, hashtag cancel Lea Michele, you'll find it. Honestly.
Which you've spent hours doing.
I've probably done nothing but. So like I touched on earlier, Streisand pre-recorded her musical numbers for the film version of Funny Girl. She was a big advocate for like singing live on set because she felt it made her acting look more authentic. She did it famously during Funny Girl. There is a song called My Man and she was adamant on it. She recorded the first half of the song live on the set on the stage as she was doing it in one take. And then they dubbed the rest of it with the track that she had set down in the studio because she wanted the first half of it to seem really poignant and emotional and really in the moment.
Sure.
And
I mean, if you've got the voice to do it, why not?
And the rest, when they panned out the camera and they did all the shots around, there wasn't such a need for it to be so focused on how close it was to her face, so her voice could be different. So she pre-recorded her musical numbers for the film version of Funny Girl around 1976, which were used for playback during filming. And that was the standard practice that was used for decades at that point and still continues today. But Barbara had never learned to lip sync to the playback because she'd only at that point ever performed live. Mm. So she'd been a Broadway star. She'd done things on TV and whatnot. And she'd only ever performed live. So she didn't know how to lip sync to her own voice back. Bearing in mind, she was very young. She was, what, 20, 21 at this point?
Mm.
And the results for this were terrible. And every test that they did, her face just couldn't match what she was singing. That's when she decided, from here on out, yeah, I need to sing live on every take for every shoot that I do.
And then something that's really hard to do, right?
And yeah, and if we have to dub it over, if we have to dub it over later and fix it up in post, that's fine. But I can't just stand here and lip sync. I have to sing live.
I'm always amazed by, you know, it's so obvious when something has a disconnect from what's been recorded to what's been been played.
And I don't want to call Lea Michele out again, but Glee is such a...
Glee, you really feel it, right? Really,
you can see that they are not connecting with what they're doing. Like, they record those how many months in advance and then perform it. But they're not connecting with the same way that they were. And it's the same with any live vocal. You're not connecting in the same way on that day as you were with that performance. I think one of the only ones that got it right, and it might be a credit to, like, the amount of Broadway talent that they had working on the show, was Smash. It feels
and
real.
Is that because it's a live performance?
It might just be that they're better actors than Lea Michele. I don't know. I don't want to turn this into a Lea Michele cancel podcast, but here we are.
It's not hard. It's not hard. I want to talk about one of my favorite diva crossovers. We've talked a little bit about this on the Judy episode, but Barbara featured on the Judy Garland show on the 13-episode run that was the Judy Garland show. I watched essentially the whole episode today. I watched every bit that Barbara was in.
How good is
it? It's phenomenal because, I mean, listeners are well aware of how much we love Judy and now know how much we love Barbara. So to see these two come together, and God, they were an absolute powerhouse. But it wasn't just the singing. There was also perhaps highly prepared and scripted, but there was this really cute back and forth dialogue between them as well.
You're so thrilling, so absolutely thrilling. I must say that we've got all your albums at home, you know, and you're so good that I hate you. I really hate you. You're so good.
Oh, Judy, that's so sweet of you. Thank you, you know. You're so great that I've been hating you for years. In fact, it's my ambition to be great enough to be hated by as many singers as you.
Oh, well, that's a nice thing for you to say. I love it. Say more. Say more.
I love you. I love you too, but don't stop hating me. I need the confidence.
No. And if you ever get a little, you know, feeling of lack of security, call me on the phone and sing a couple of notes to me, and I'll give you hatred like you've never gotten. That's good.
I love that. It's this really beautiful moment that, I mean, this is Babs when she was, I keep calling her Babs, like she's my best mate.
I've resisted doing it the entire podcast
so
far.
I'm doing it. She's a good mate of ours. This is Barbara really early on in her career. So this is before she's even made a movie. She was already a Broadway success. She'd already released the Barbara Streisand album. But so it's still this quite green version of Barbara.
It's very, yes, it is. It's very the green version, but it's also very the, for anybody here that's seen Funny Girl, she's the Fanny Bryce version of Barbara. Yeah. She is.
And she's
the,
right. And you mentioned the other day, I talked about her being quite green and you said, but she's got this real back and forth. And you're right. There is these moments where she really has this great,
banter.
I don't know. It's really interesting to watch the two together, sort of knowing their characters a little bit. She actually more recently looks back on this experience, and I'd love to read you this quote that she has about her time on the Judy Garland show. She said about Judy, this is Barbara speaking, "She was holding my hand and I thought, gee, she seems nervous. At that time, I wasn't nervous. I was still very young, I think about to do Funny Girl, and now when I think back on it, I think, oh my God, I know exactly what she's feeling." Or, you know, the fears. It's like as you get older and people are kind of looking for you to fail more, I think, not people, not the audience, but, you know, critics or producers or whatever. And I just felt for her. I felt her anxiety. Part of me is much more relaxed than I've ever been. Less frightened, less anxious. On the other hand, it's a coming of age thing. And she was much younger than I am at that point. But there are things with careers. I just understand the anxiety, even though in a sense I'm calmer. It's a dichotomy. It's hard to explain. You wonder, well, do I give up? Do I retire? Or do I get more in before my time is up? I get goosebumps reading that. I think
it's a lot, and it's a lot to like unpack. And yeah,
I can just imagine how nervous Judy was, because Judy was this nervous personality and wanted to do.
But as we said, she banked everything on that TV show, on the Judy Garland show. It was $24 million contract from CBS. Like it was a huge thing.
And you can see it in the set designs, and of course, we're going to pop this entire clip up on our website of Barbara on the Judy show, and it is worth a watch. It's really, really great. But it's this beautiful glimpse in Barbara's life as well, where she goes, "I just wasn't nervous at that time. I was new and I was hungry and I was excited for it." But her looking back in it with the lens that she has today, going, I get that. I get the kind of pressure that the industry puts on you, and that they kind of waiting for you to fail and you kind of trip yourself up. I couldn't imagine living under those pressures.
As someone who's lived with those pressures most of their life, I understand that. No, but seriously, for me, I love it because it's like, it's the juxtaposition between the naivety of a Barbara Streisand at 19, 20, 21, that whenever it was that she was appearing on the Judy Garland show, and the Barbara Streisand we know and love today, who has this massive career, who doesn't perform in public all that often, who now understands and can look back on those times and think, oh God, it was a different beast for me at that age. And her at the age that she was to now, like things change exponentially. And we see that throughout Barbara's career as well. I think that's a really great thing for her to sort of sit back and reflect on.
Yeah. It's a really interesting way to look at this perspective.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to look at, for me, to look at Judy Garland through the lens of Barbara Streisand.
Yeah, and look at one of our divas who is no longer with us, the only diva on our list who is no longer with us, through the perspective of someone else who to this day is still living and still knows.
Yeah. And acknowledges that and says, I'm obviously a calmer person in a lot of ways, but I get it. I get how hard that would have been for her. I want to finish that. We've played it before, but it is such a beautiful clip. It's just a little bit of Barbara and Judy singing the iconic Happy Days.
I love it so much. Oh my goodness. And just to see them with such frivolity and such laughter and like both of them in their element at that time.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing. And it's something that, I mean, we've both seen that clip where there's like a music teacher who analyzes like clips from the past and speaks about like so many people look at back at that as a lesson in music and how to sing with another person.
Like your connection to your scene partner, yeah. 100%.
Unbelievable.
Thank God we looked at it before we did this podcast. One of my favorite iconic moments of Barbara Streisand has to be when she made an appearance on the Oprah Winfrey Show. And this little interaction happened. The first time I heard about it was through the 2004 special that Kathy Griffin did, which was called Allegedly. She had a story to say about Barbara's microphone. This was the interaction between Barbara and Oprah.
I wanted to say this before we go to, I own this studio. I've been here, I don't know how many years. I've never seen a white mic.
So it's actually off-white to match my off-white. Off-white.
Will you tell the audience how that happened? I've never seen, just before Barbara started singing, I said, where'd you get a white mic?
Because it was a black mic last night, right?
Yes.
And all you saw against this sea of white, I like simplicity and monochromatic frames.
Yes.
So I thought, you know, just look at, if the mic melts into my sweater, in other words, it just makes the focus on the song.
Okay, so you had the mic sprayed.
That's right.
Okay. We'll be right back.
So you had the mic sprayed. Yep. Cut to commercial.
Yep.
Oprah gets nooch, absolutely nothing from Barbara. She's like, yes, I had it sprayed to the off-white color that my Donna Karan suit is made in. And I don't know what the issue is.
I love that correction. It's not white. It's off-white.
It's off-white. My outfit isn't white.
Do you know what? I kind of get it. A black mic would look funny.
Really? It's not something that a lot of people would have realized, but for her being such a perfectionist, and this is where it comes from. This is where that diva thing comes from, is she took Oprah's mic. And during the night where they had their pre-show and the actual filming of the show, she had it spray painted the same color as her Donna Karan suit. And if that doesn't make a diva, I don't know what does.
I love that. So, Tequila, I've put in a call to the Braxton sisters and I've said, have you got anyone that can help us with this next segment? And they've come back with this. Okay, they sent us Tony, but we'll work with that.
Oh, I thought it was Tamar. Sorry. The more famous of the Braxton sisters.
Of course, Mary, did you know, let's have a chat about the fun facts and interesting trivia that we've found out about the diva in our research.
So Streisand has a term named after her called the Streisand effect.
Yes, 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 yes.
Have you heard about this?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So it's used to describe a situation where someone tries to draw attention away from a subject, but ends up unintentionally drawing even more attention to it.
Right.
The term...
Because a photographer took a photo
of her
house.
The term was coined in 2003 after Streisand sued a photographer who was working for the California Coastal Records Project for taking aerial photos of her estate, as she argued they would show people how to break into her property.
So now, I've seen these aerial photos. View,
and yes, we've all seen them. She lives on a cliff.
How you can break into
she lives on a cliff, but you might be forgiven for like trying to find ways to break into the perimeter of the property.
Oh, okay. Which clearly you are.
Well, I'm not, but apparently she thought that people were. But in reality, they were solely meant for scientists and researchers who study coastal erosion. At the time of the lawsuit, the photos had only been seen 6 times, 2 of which were by Streisand's lawyers.
And her lawyers, yeah.
Once the lawsuit became public knowledge, they were seen over 1 million times. So it's really funny because if she had said nothing...
It's like a backwards logic, yeah. Right? It's like this...
If she had said nothing, nobody would have cared fine, yeah. And it would have been fine. She said something and then all of a sudden you have over 1 million people viewing your property.
And now any time that something like that happens where someone accidentally draws attention to something they were trying to cover...
It's called the Streisand effect.
So Barbara Streisand, when she was growing up, she actually went to school with Neil Diamond and was in the choir... With Neil Diamond.
Yes, and they were. And years later released You Don't Bring Me Flowers.
Which
together.
Is the second time they've sung together because they were together in the same year level in the same choir.
It's a really cute moment.
Yeah.
So, a little, like, personal fun fact. I realised doing this research that the only diva that I haven't seen from this podcast that we're doing, the only diva that I haven't seen live is Judy Garland. For the fact that she passed before I was born. It was 2013. My cousin was getting married. We went back to the UK for her wedding. We went to her wedding on the Friday night. And then in my very hungover state at 7 o'clock in the morning, we got on a flight from the north of the UK down to London. And we went and saw Barbara Streisand the very next day on the Saturday. For me, it was one of the most life-changing moments of my entire life to see someone that I've admired from Woe to Go, from Funny Girl and Yentl, to today,
yeah,
live in person. And we were at the O2 Arena in London, the very back row, and we paid more money than I pay in rent a month.
Yeah.
Per ticket.
Right.
To sit in the very back row of the O2 Arena, which is like 60,000 people. It's a fucking huge arena. And the only thing my mum could say, because it was me, my mum, and my dad, the only thing my mum could say is she didn't sing her favourite song.
Oh.
And it ruined the whole concert for her because I'm really upset that she didn't sing my favorite song. And then she told me the song. I couldn't tell you what the song was because it wasn't one of her hits. It was like a B-side to a single from like 1970. And she was like, I'm really sad she didn't sing that song. And I'm like, I have literally no idea what you're talking about. Like, this is the craziest thing.
It's like after I went to Cher and then I realized that she didn't sing Song for the Lonely and I cried.
Standing in the middle of an empty circuit dance floor.
I cried. I was a little in my feelings that day, though.
But seriously, one of the most incredible performances I've seen in my entire life. And she brought her son, Jason Gould, up on stage. And he sang with her and they duetted on a couple of songs. Mm. Mostly his songs. I think she was like trying to like launch his career. Yeah, yeah. And I think that's fine. But I would have liked her to sing like You Don't Bring Me Flowers or any one of the other big duets that she's known for. She was one of the final divas on my list that I knew were still alive that I could tick off and be like, okay, my queer card is full.
If there's one way to describe your queer card, it's very full. So one of the things I love about Barbara is that she changed her name at one point. She changed it.
Such a significant change.
She changed it from Barbara to Barbara. She took the second A out of her name. So she was born with the 3 A's, as you know, it's the typical spelling of Barbara. But she's now, of course, known by the shortened version with one less A. And she says it's because she wanted to change her name and she wanted to be edgy, but she didn't want to actually
change
her name.
The whole thing is baffling to me. Because if you wanted to change your name, and we've seen so many divas on this podcast change their actual names. Frances Ethel Gum.
Somebody said that she could have been Joni Sands because her middle name is Joan.
No, I don't buy it. I'm not getting it.
It's another one of those sliding door moments. Imagine if it was Jodie Sands that we loved as much as Barbara Streisand.
Yeah,
it's an interesting world to consider, but it does speak volumes about this thing that Barbara has where if people tell her that she needs to do something, she won't do it. And people told her that she should change her name and she's like...
Okay, one letter goes, that's it.
She's like, I both want to change my name, but also I'm not going to prove you right that I can't be Barbara Streisand. So here it is.
Just shorten it. Just make it... We'll go from Barbara to Barbara. I didn't know that she took a job as an usher at the Lunt-Fontaine Theatre for The Sound of Music in 1960. So she was an usher during the run of this show.
Apparently she would take any job in
anything in that kind of industry. I mean, she was 16
when she moved to New York, so she was taking whatever she could get to
living on people's couches. Mm. It's great. There's a great story in her biography where she talks about how she was living on different friends' couches and things like that, and she was... kind of a gypsy, kind of a vagabond and living between places. And when she returned home, her mother said to her, oh, no, you can't be doing that. She was like, no, I have to do it because I'm going to be a star.
Mm.
If we've heard on this podcast once, we've heard it a thousand times about someone declaring to their family that they're going to be a star.
Yeah, but you know what? What we don't hear is all the people that say that and don't become stars. Like, there's still a very...
You're hearing my voice right now, Robert. How very rude of you.
There's still a big hit and miss ratio.
As I was saying, she took a job as an usher at the Lunt-Fontaine Theatre for The Sound of Music in 1960. During the run of the play, she heard that the casting director was auditioning for more singers, for like pit singers or background singers or even like ensemble. And it marked the first time that she sang in pursuit of a job. The director for the show felt she was not right for the part, but he encouraged her to begin including her talent as a singer on her resume where she hadn't beforehand, which is not long after that where she booked Fanny Bryce in Funny Girl.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting because she always considered herself... Again, I'm going to get into this in a minute, but she always considered herself an actress and not a singer.
Yeah, but then that was when she sort of realized, okay, I can capitalize on my singing and then skew that into an acting career later. She's had the same manager for over 50 years, Martin Ehrlichman, who has been her manager since before she was famous. I just think that shows some real integrity of character, that you stick with the guy that you made it big with and... to this day, you're still managing your career.
It's amazing because you think of the amount of times Judy went through different managers and different people to like manage her career. To have someone that lasted the entirety of Barbara's career it's astounding.
Did you know that she has the second most gold album certifications behind only Elvis Presley? 47 times she's gone gold.
That's wild. And on her most recent duets album, she sings with Elvis Presley. So they spliced a performance of his with a performance of hers.
Yeah, right.
And they finally got to duet after all of this time. Also, in talking simpatico, Elvis was the first person that she went to above Kris Kristofferson for A Star Is Born to play the lead. Did you have that on you?
No.
Oh, they thought that that would be a great revival for Elvis's career in 1976 to have him come back with Barbara Streisand in the remake of A Star Is Born.
Yeah, of course. And then he died just a year later.
A year later, of course. And we've talked at length about A Star Is Born. We've talked about the Judy version.
Yeah.
And now the Barbara version. And then we talked about how Cher was passed over for the Barbara version.
Right.
In 1976.
I love when our divas cross over. I think it's so fascinating.
As the series progresses, I have another three Star Is Born facts to intertwine.
Tequila, speaking of crossovers, we spoke on the Cher episode about the fact that Cher was one of the only people who had both an Oscar and a number one Billboard single. And you said to me, who are the other people? And I said, I've got no idea. Please don't ask me questions that I don't know about. Just enjoy the things I bring to you. Well, I am nothing if not a good podcast co-host. I have those facts for you now because Barbara is another one of them, and there's only five. So Barbara, as well as Cher, has also had a number one single and a Best Actress Academy Award. The other three being Jamie Foxx, Frank Sinatra, and Bing Crosby.
That's really interesting. I love that. Did you know that in an interview with Variety in 2018, Barbara Streisand revealed that two of her three dogs were clones? This blows my mind. As someone that has dogs and loves them very, very dearly, as I was researching this last night, and getting more information on it, I turned to my baby boy who was sitting at the top of the couch, like literally on top of me. I turned to him and I was like, if you ever die, I will clone you because I think you're beautiful. I love you.
I don't know why, just... because your dog is...
No, stop. He's stunning. He's a little pugglier and he has an ugly face, but he's my favorite.
An ugly face and an ugly personality.
So...
just like you.
Variety reported that the dogs, Miss Violet and Miss Scarlet, had been cloned from cells taken from the mouth and stomach of Miss Streisand's late dog, Samantha, who she talks about at length in so many interviews, who was 14 when she died in 2017.
I wonder how much this cost her.
I can tell you exactly how much it cost because I have here costs approximately $50,000.
Oh, God.
Per dog.
Ah, well.
Per dog. $100,000 to clone two dogs. I would, if I had that kind of money, I would do it to my dogs.
If you had that kind of money, you would not be here with me right now.
I wouldn't. Well, I would because this is my passion project and I love it. And you've got to stay humble to the people that you grew up with. We've only known each other 2 years, but we've really grown up together.
18 months too long.
Cut it there. I haven't got anything further to say on that.
So something I found fascinating that I figured out is that she was the first choice for Sally Bowles in Cabaret. So, of course, that's a role that very iconically went to Liza Minnelli, which she won the Academy Award for.
My favourite diva of all time.
But that could have been Barbara Streisand, and I kind of see that for her.
This is where you and I differ quite a bit. I don't see that at all. I don't know that I could see another diva other than Liza Minnelli playing that role. So I'd like to throw things to like a weird area of the internet. That
what is the internet for, if not?
If not for weird.
Not for the weird places.
I'd like to specifically talk about the mall that she has built under her Malibu ranch.
Okay, I know nothing about this.
Okay, this is my favorite. Okay. So under her Malibu ranch, so there are three houses on her ranch. She has the guest house, the grandma house, and her house. Under her house in the Malibu Ranch, she has a basement with a bunch of shop fronts that have been modeled to look like quaint old-timey storefronts where she shows off many of her collections.
Ah, like a little Barbara Museum?
Kind of, but they look really like they're weird. In
shop fronts?
Yeah, so she has the costumes from Funny Girl, she has the costumes from Hello Dolly, and they sit in these window fronts. In this street, this old-timey, like, Victorian street, she has a gelato shop down there.
Like, but are we talking, like, something that looks like a gelato shop or you can go down and get some gelato?
She took Ryan Murphy and Lady Gaga down and John Travolta down to her basement and got them all. She it was like, here are my costumes. Look at this street, look at that, blah, blah, blah. And, oh, by the way, would you like gelato? She once told Harper's Bazaar that instead of just storing my things in the basement, I can make a street of shops and just display them.
That bit I get, but...
Yeah, 100%.
Like a gelato
There are photos and
did
a
she
link.
Just get James to run down to serve the gelato?
Maybe, who knows? She's just like, where's those step kids? Get them in here and downstairs. Downstairs now. There are photos in this link that I will put up on the website, and I beg you to look at them. It's the most bizarre, because she discusses the building of the mall at length in her 2010 book... This book has plagued me for most of my gay adult life. It's a 2010 book called My Passion for Design. It's photos of her house. It's photos of her Malibu ranch and what it looks like. But she takes you on a deep dive. The problem is you can't buy this book. This book exists. They release a couple of copies every year. I've tried for at least 7 years now to buy this book. They do not ship outside of America and they only release a handful of copies a year. It is the most fascinating and the most wild look because she is the most extravagant person. Her rooms are all designed by Donna Karan in her house. And the whole thing is just so bizarre. Like, it makes no sense whatsoever. We will pop this up on the website so you can look at the layout of the underground mall. It's silly. I'm going to show you quickly. That's what I was getting to because I wanted you to see it.
We'll pop a link to all these photos on the website, but yeah.
It's crazy. It is literally the Harper's Bazaar website. And she has all of these costumes, all of these shoes. She has a doll shop. She has a gelato shop.
That little shop street looks quaint. I like
it. It does look quaint.
I'll put that in my house. Okay, Tequila, it's time, as we do every episode of Divas on Divas, to talk about why it is that we as gay men and why we as a community are so obsessed.
And I was like, why are you so obsessed with me?
Barbara, as many of our divas, started off very early with her connection with the gay scene. Her first sort of time performing on a stage was, in fact, a talent competition that she entered. It was at a place called The Lion, which was a gay club in the Greenwich Village, and she won that competition and wowed people so much that she then went on to perform in this gay club. It was really her first sort of reliable performance job. She went on to perform there for several weeks.
It's incredible, because wasn't she only 18 at the time?
Yeah.
So she said in an interview once that the gay community always supported me from the start, and I will always be grateful. And like, how many divas on our list have we had that we've said that about?
Yeah.
That's where they got their start, in the bathhouses or with the gay community and gay clubs. And
yeah,
it's like
the relation to the gay community started so early. People often talk about the divas of today who kind of follow the same sort of suit. So if you look at people like Lady Gaga, who also has a massive gay following and has always been very generous and very aware of her gay fans, and you look at people like Taylor Swift, who probably less successfully does it but tries to have this connection with her gay fans as well. People are going to kill me for that, but you know, she does come into repute for it. But it has become this synonymous thing that our divas and our big personalities have always been quite generous to the gay community.
100%. Decades later, she said in an article to Variety, "I remember sitting in a theatre and watching Larry Kramer's play The Normal Heart with tears running down my cheeks. It was 1985 and Ronald Reagan was president, and it was heartbreaking to know that people were dying while he refused to even say the word AIDS." For a diva of her stature to come out and talk about the AIDS epidemic and the things that were happening at that time... And speak about them
when
on a
nobody else wanted
level.
To talk about
and,
it.
And she spoke about George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan and all of those presidents that she saw come and go and spoke out against their policies. That says a lot in terms of the way that she supported our queer community.
So Billboard in 2017 asked for love letters, for famous people to write love letters.
Isn't it beautiful?
To the LGBTIQ community. And she did say that. She said, the gay community supported me from the start and I'll always be grateful. She went on to say, "Marriage equality is a law and that deserves a toast to all of us, because we're unique and beautiful in our own way and entitled to love and be loved by whoever we choose." So she never minced her words about her support for the community, and she was always a strong campaigner, both for our community and against those that were against our community.
In 2004, she had a very impassioned speech at the Human Rights Commission in Los Angeles, where she delivered a fiery pro-gay, anti-Bush speech. This was after the Bush 9/11. This was after the Iraq War, all of that. She said, "The Bush administration wants to change the positive, inclusive direction of our Constitution by calling for an amendment that authorizes discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation." Well, I say, no way! That's great.
There you go, two words.
You got two words. No way. And she said that to a group of like 1,700, which has been reported, power gays and lesbians, which is like you're giving that kind of impassioned speech to a bunch of queer folk.
Yeah.
More power to you, honey.
Again, we have this notion too that comes up quite a bit about the kind of personality that she has. So it has been said that she's strong, she's sassy, she's loud, she's larger than life, she's beautiful to look at, despite what you feel about her nose. She's quite beautiful to look at. And she has this amazing voice. And those are things that any fan really clings to. But, you know, as a community, we love this sassy, larger-than-life quality that our divas have. And it comes up episode after episode that there is this common trait that connects us with who these people are at their very core.
Do you think it's really like an anachronistic, like they're willing to go just fuck the system, fuck everyone? Like a lot of them will stand up against what is deemed acceptable of the times and just go, no.
Yeah.
We couldn't do this segment without the fact that Barbara Streisand's son, Jason Gould, that she had with Elliot Gould,
is a flaming homo.
Is a homosexual. And has supported her on a lot of the tours that she has done throughout her life. Most recently, the one that I saw in 2013. And she's always been super supportive of that.
She says in a quote, "I would never wish for my son to be anything but what he is. No one on earth has the right to tell anyone that their love for another human being is morally wrong." One of the things I really love about her commentary on the gay community or the queer community is that she uses these really inclusive terms. She brings it into none of us should be treated in a bad way. Isn't it great that all of us have the choice to love who we love? And I think that's a really powerful thing to do because it just normalizes queer life.
Of course it does. Yeah, it just makes it seem like it's part of the everyday rhetoric that we hear day in, day out.
One last little note about Jason Gould. I love that he must get sick of being asked questions about his mother, but he was asked, is it hard dating as the son of a massive gay icon? And his response was simply, well, it's bloody hard dating as anybody, right? Like, dating's just a hard thing to do. He goes, but you never know what kind of preconceived notions people have of you or what they might think of you because of it. But I just love that sort of blasé, like, dating's just hard.
It's hard,
right?
Full stop.
You would know.
I really do. So every episode, we like to give the listeners something, just a little sound grab of what makes the diva that we've been talking about an actual diva. And I don't know that I can think of one, apart from the microphone thing we spoke about earlier on the Oprah show. I don't know that I can think of one that solidifies her as a diva more than this.
And you ask Siri, you know, how to pronounce Barbara Streisand, and she says, you pronounce Barbara Streisand.
Yeah.
Barbara, you know, so I called him...
You called Tim Cook.
And he very nice.
The head of Apple.
The head of Apple.
Yeah.
Well, I had called Steve Jobs before when he was alive.
I was going to say. Let me guess. It went to voicemail.
That was about something else. But.
He didn't pick up.
If you don't ask, you can't guess.
Then maybe we'll
right?
kill the man. No,
imagine going, I'm just going to call the CEO of Apple.
Imagine having that much power in your life.
I'm going to tell him, you're pronouncing my last name wrong, which you. I can't hear it.
This is really fascinating because we've had this back and forth tonight that you can't hear the difference between Streisand and Streisand.
Well, I heard
Streisand and Streisand.
Streisand.
But if you say it fast.
Streisand. I can't say Streisand. Is that
Streisand.
It? I have to stop and think about it. Streisand. Streisand.
Barbara Streisand.
Streisand. Yeah. Streisand.
Streisand.
Did I do it right? Streisand?
Mara Mulstein.
Streisand. I did it wrong again.
No, that was wrong.
Streisand. God.
I love it. But
I'm sure people want to listen to us try to pronounce
it. When we listen back to this, it's going to be really, it's going to be really obvious that.
I won't be. I'm shit at this sort of
no,
stuff.
No, I think you've done it. I haven't heard up until we've had this conversation now. I think you've done it right.
I had to make you say it earlier because I have no idea. But on this moment, I just think the idea that Barbara Streisand has Tim Cook on her speed dial.
And the fact that she had Steve Jobs on her speed dial.
Oh, yeah.
Well.
I talked to him as well.
Oh, yeah. I've got everyone. And there's a really great interview as well at some point that we will pop up on the website where she talks about having a direct line to the White House while Bill Clinton was in power as well. Yeah. She's like, I might not have gotten straight through, but after like maybe one or two people I would have gotten through. And I'm like, imagine having that much power.
I know, you get drunk on that kind of power.
I get drunk on less than that, darling.
We're talking about those three bottles of wine you brought over tonight. Tequila, that is about all we have time for another episode of Diva on Divas.
You can find us on Facebook at Divas on Divas and on Instagram at Divas on Divas. You can also find all of the content we put up from today's episode up on our website at divasondivas.com.
One last thing for today, we'll wrap up like we do every week with a moment from the Diva Vault. What have we got for people this time?
This episode, we're going to take our listeners out with a little Streisand at her best and at her most disco drag fabulous with a little clip from the main event.
And until next time, don't forget, it's Streisand, not Streisand.
With an S, not a Z.
I gotta thank my lucky stars. I move. Hooray, hooray, down the lane. I can't wait. I
gotta celebrate.